Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here this evening to this lecture and debate. This event is an important one, both for LSE and for Imperial, because it marks the beginning of what we hope to be a fairly intensive series of collaborations between our two institutions. As the director of the LSE, it seems to me that it's very important for students and faculty at the LSE to be able to be in contact with those working in the natural sciences. LSE is a specialized social science institution, but many of the things which affect our world today are driven by scientific innovation and technological change. And I think if the LSE community is not directly in touch with the causes, conditions, and outcomes of those sorts of innovation, something very important is lost. So we hope from our side this collaboration will deepen over the next few months and years. If I can presume to speak a bit for the Imperial side of this collaboration, from that side, I think very important to recognize that science always functions in a social context. All forms of scientific discovery and technological change produce, are geared to social consequences, and of course raise ethical issues too. So we think it's good for those working in the natural sciences to have contacts with us too. So this is like a marker, this lecture series, of this progressive collaboration, which we hope will cover research and a range of other areas linking the LSE and Imperial College. The format is that this is the first of four lectures in the series. The next one will also be at LSE on the 29th of April, and the title of that discussion is Who Says Our Food Is Safe? Question mark. Future ones at Imperial next autumn term will be on new genetics and society, one of them, and the other on science and the media. And the structure of this evening's debate is that our distinguished main speaker, who I'll introduce in a second, more formally, Professor Walpert, will talk for about half an hour. After that, each of our three equally distinguished panelists will comment for 5 to 6 minutes on what he has to say. Following that, I'll give Lewis an attempt to make a time to make a brief reply to what was said about his lecture or presentation, and then we'll have open discussion with the audience. Well, let me first of all formally welcome Lewis here, Lewis Walpert, who sits at this edge of the table here. Lewis is Professor of Biology as Applied to Medicine in the Department of Anatomy and Developmental Biology of University College London. He has presented science on both radio and TV for many years. He's also been chairman of the Committee for the Public Understanding of Science. His book, Malignant Sagnus, The Anatomy of Depression, was published by Faber in 1999 and has become very famous work. His previous books include The Triumph of the Embryo, published in 1991, and, well, a range of other publications that I won't go through, but there are many of them. He also writes a very well-known column for The Independent. Having seen him in action in Parliament Hill Fields tennis courts for many weeks and many years past, I can also vouch for the fact that he's a very effective and distinguished tennis player, in addition to his other accomplishments. Rod Smith, sitting in the down the end there, the other end there, is currently head of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Imperial College and a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering. He has held previous appointments at Cambridge and Sheffield universities. He is conducting research on technical and organizational aspects of railway operations and has currently been the chairman of Railtrack's team investigating the gauge corner cracking of rails, a topic dear to all of our hearts. He also has some connection with the only word of Japanese that I know, Shinkansen, which means bullet train. The only reason I know it is I got stuck in a railway station looking for the Shinkansen when I was in Japan, and so I learned the term, and he was instrumental in acquiring one of these trains, a bullet train, as a donation from Japan to the National Railway Museum in York. David Jeffries is Chief Executive and Director of the Medical Devices Agency of the Department of Health. He is a physician by training who joined the Department of Health in 1984 after a career in clinical and academic medicine. He has published and lectured extensively on medical regulation. He is also a professor of medicine at the University of Newcastle, and he sits three away from me. Finally, John Adams, Professor of Geography, UCL, was a member of the original board of directors of Friends of the Earth in the early 1970s and has been a participant in debates about the management of environmental risk ever since. He has published widely on planning, transport, and risk management issues, both in specialist journals and the national press. He is a frequent contributor to radio and television programs on these subjects. And since in my life I've also worked a bit on the theme of risk, I'd like to say how much his writings have personally influenced me, and I think everybody really who works directly in the field of the analysis of risk. The topic of tonight's discussion, you'll see up on the screen there, it's risk and society. Is science dangerous? Lewis's answer is probably going to be no, but could I please ask you to welcome Professor Wolpert to the LSE. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right? Yes, you can. Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be asked to give this lecture. I can also tell you, I know the chairman's introduced me, he's a very, very good tennis player. That's what I can tell you. He's better than me, I'm sorry to say. However, so I want to talk about, is science dangerous? And I'll go to my first slide, which isn't on there. And the point that I want to make is from the Bible, and the Lord God commands. Can you read? Is it in focus? I'm blind as a bat, so, you know. Is it all right? Okay. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. And you will say, what on earth has that got to do with science? You know, that's about good and evil. But just let me tell you two further things. First of all, in Milton's Paradise Lost, the serpent addresses that tree of knowledge as the mother of science. And there's another scene in Paradise Lost where the archangel Raphael is telling Adam how it all happens. And Adam's very grateful, and I'm not going to quote Milton, but effectively Adam says to him, look, I'm very grateful for what you've told me, but just a few more questions I'd like to know. You know, why is the world so big and so... And the archangel taps him on the shoulder and says, be lowly wise. Just concern yourself with local things. Do not ask these big questions. Let me make a strong statement. I'm going to make lots of strong statements. The idea that knowledge is dangerous, and I, of course, will argue that the best way to understand the world is science. I'll come back to that in a moment. The idea that knowledge is dangerous permeates Western culture. I challenge you, and I challenge many audiences, to tell me of one single novel in English literature where the scientist comes out well. They are male, emotionally impoverished, and dangerous, and middle-aged. You know what I mean. Yes, I know there's Lydgate in Middlemarch by George Eliot. Virtually nowhere, I can't think of one. But if you just think of the others, Frankenstein, the Island of Dr. Moreau, I mean, the whole of Western literature is anti-science. The idea that literature actually reflects the way society works is junk. Sorry, on a totally different... No, I mustn't get involved in that. I'm also a depressive. There's not a single description in any well-known novel, and forget about the bell jar, that gives a good description of depression. I'd just like to attack the arts. I'll do the same with sociology in a moment. The point I want to make about science is that it is the best way to understand the world, and what's more, it's peculiar. I've written a book, as Tony said, called The Unnatural Nature of Science. Science goes against common sense, and I think, therefore, when it comes to ethical issues, there's really quite a lot of confusion about what's going on. Which is my next one. Now, before I get onto that, though, I want to make the point that, and it's a key point in what I want to say, is that there is a fundamental difference, that's not fundamental, but an important difference between science and technology. People hate me, not hate me, don't like this idea, but that doesn't matter. The basic idea is that technology is about doing something, and science is about understanding. And one of the key points that I want to make is that reliable scientific knowledge is value-free. It has zero ethical content. That we are not the center of the universe, as Copernicus and Galileo showed, is neither good nor bad. That genes may determine certain of your behaviors, whether it's homosexuality, genius, it's neither good nor bad. That's the way the world is. Technology, on the other hand, is about applying science. However, it's important to realize, in history, science had zero impact on technology until the late 18th century. And Galileo put it very clearly, technology is about trial and error, and this is about Galileo. We are certain that the first inventor of the telescope was a simple spectacle maker who, handling by chance different forms of glasses, looked also by chance through two of them, one convex, one concave, held at different distances from the eye, saw and noted the unexpected result, and thus founded the instrument. My best example of how science and technology are different is the elephant. Yes? The elephant on any score is wonderful technology. Yeah, I hope you'll agree. Evolution knows no science. It's trial and error, I'm afraid to say. Now, science is peculiar, and a great deal of it goes against common sense. That's nobody's fault. And the only people to really come across the idea of science were the Greeks. And my hero, I think he's probably the greatest scientist who ever lived, was Archimedes. And I bet you, if I set you this little problem, you're in a swimming pool, yes? And you're in a little boat in the swimming pool, and you've got a rock in the boat. You're quite happy there. And you throw the rock into the water. Does the level of the water in the pool go up, down, or stay the same? Archimedes would have sneered at so simple a problem. Bet you don't know the answer. Do you want to vote? Those of you who think it remains the same. Those of you who think it goes up. Those of you who think it goes down. I'm afraid that's the way it goes. So even the simplest science is really not very easy. And the idea of standing back from nature, applying mathematics to it, really is a totally Greek invention. All science, as we know it, comes from the Greeks. Yes, I know Needham wrote 7 volumes of Science and Civilization in China, but you actually read what Needham says, what's interesting, how the Chinese did not get to science. Wonderful technology, no science. And if I could just remind you, all those wonderful Renaissance buildings, Gothic cathedrals and so forth, were built on zero science. They were built on what someone wittily called the 5-minute principle. What's that? 5-minute theorem. You put up the building, you take away the props, you wait for 5 minutes, if it stands up, you assume it'll think and off and it fell down. I'm sorry, I have Einstein on my side. The developments of Western science have been based on 2 great achievements, the invention of the formal logical system in Euclidean geometry by the Greek philosophers and the discovery of the possibility of finding out causal relationships by a systematic experiment at the Renaissance. In my opinion, we need not be astonished that the Chinese sages did not make these steps. The astonishing thing is these discoveries were made at all. I just want to point out that one of the disappointing things about the social sciences is that they have provided zero insight into the way that science actually works. My enemies, and I must declare it, are the sociologists of science, who are relativists, who actually believe that the real world has only a small part to play in the construction of scientific theories and that it's all socially determined. The philosophers of science are my friends. They're just disappointing. They don't tell us anything of the slightest interest about the nature of science. But to come back now to the ethical issues. So I want to argue, because I make the sharp distinction between science and technology, that reliable scientific knowledge is value-free. It's the applications that really matter. And that, first of all, raises the issue of what is the social role or the social responsibility of the scientist? Now, I love my scientific colleagues, and there are all these people who say, what's got to happen is scientists must be more socially responsible. I'm very fond of my scientific colleagues, even my non-scientific colleagues. I wouldn't let them choose me a tie, let alone make an ethical decision on my behalf. You must be very unwise to let any group of experts make ethical decisions for society as a whole. They have neither the right nor the skill that right belongs to us in general. The best example of this, I think, was experiments on human embryos. There was the Warnock Committee was set up to look at this whole issue, widely debated. A decision was taken in Parliament as to what you are allowed to do. The Human Fertilization and Embryo Committee was set up, and they regulated. I don't agree with all their decisions, but that's not the point. The nature of a democracy is that you don't have to agree with everything. That's just tough luck. But at least it was openly discussed, and no particular small group of people made any of those decisions. But how serious are these ethical decisions? Particularly, I'm a biologist, I work on embryos. As a theoretician, I must admit, I hardly ever touch one, but that's neither. The issue, for example, for me, it's one of the great, not a mystery anymore, no, it is a mystery. Why is there such hysteria about cloning? Just before we get there, let's see what my next slide is. Oh, well, this is just to show the unnatural nature of science. Sorry. When you pull the string, which way will that go? Those of you who think it'll go that way? Those of you who think it'll go that way, you're wrong, it'll go that way. I didn't know either, sorry, I bought a yo-yo and tried it. I just want to tell you, even the simplest, the idea, just let me give you, for me, which still is mysterious. Force does not cause motion, it causes acceleration. When you are going at 400 miles an hour in your jet to wherever you're going, there is no force pushing you. Zero force. It's only when the speed changes that there's a force. Weird. Sorry. So, you know, and these are trivial examples. When you get to complicated, when you get to difficult science, it gets very, very, very much worse. So the question then is, here's Mary Kenny is my friend now, but I was furious with her about this. This is a typical newspaper headline. This was when Peter Goodfellow and Robin Lovell Badge discovered the gene which determines male and female sex, the one, the Y chromosome, and they showed they could make a female mouse male by putting in the gene. And she compared them to the Nazi doctors who experimented on human beings. I think the issue of animal experimentation is a tricky one, and it's not one that I want to get involved in here, although I'm very happy to have discussion on it. The more important point is, what about humans? What about cloning? I mean, some of the people who have spoken about cloning, and of course the real difficulty here is Frankenstein. Mary Shelley, I'm sure she didn't, well, I don't know she didn't mean it, is the unintentional evil fairy godmother of genetics. It's almost impossible to discuss human genetics without the particularly genetic manipulation, without the image of Frankenstein coming into play. I don't understand why, but it's clearly something that really matters. And when cloning came out, people were saying, let me give you a quote, Jeremy Rifkin demanded a worldwide ban and that it should carry a penalty on a par with rape, child abuse, and murder. I call that moral masturbation. I'm sorry, I don't wish to be rude. No, I want to say that's a phrase Mark Twain used. We looked it up on the web. Moral masturbation is the situation where you can take a wonderfully high, pompous moral tone on issues that don't really matter, and it's a way of avoiding the real issues in society. So let's talk about cloning. I offer a bottle of champagne to anybody who will tell me one new ethical issue that reproductive cloning, and by that I mean reproductive cloning, involves. Let me show you what, I think I've got reproductive cloning. I don't want to get too involved in teaching you about cloning, but this is from old experiments 30 years ago by John Gurdon, in which you take out the nucleus containing the genetic information from an early embryo, put it back into an enucleated egg, and you get identical frogs. They also showed that you can get embryonic stem cells at an early stage. If you inject those stem cells into the early embryo, for example, if you take them from a black mice, they will contribute to all the tissues of the embryo. And in fact, John even showed that if you took skin cells, put them in culture, and then took their nuclei, you didn't get a decent frog, but you got a pretty respectable tadpole. So my offer is, if you can tell me reproductive cloning, we're not talking about stem cell cloning, I'll come back to that in a moment. If you can tell me one new ethical issue that human reproductive cloning raises, I give you a bottle of champagne. There's a slight snag. If your suggestion is wrong, you've got to give me two. It's to avoid trivial suggestions. Now, I have done this dozens of times. No one has ever come back to me. People say, oh, the child will look like its parent. I say, have you seen my son? The parent will be very concerned how the child develops. Have you seen the parents of my children's school? I mean, you know, it's bizarre. Now, I'm against cloning for a completely different reason. The safety of the chances with reproductive cloning of human beings, the chances of the child being abnormal is very, very high, and I would ban it on safety grounds, nothing whatsoever to do with some new ethical issue. It's the same problem as any new medical treatment. It's also important to realize, it's very important to realize, that what cloning involves is making an identical twin. I don't think there's anything obscene or terrible in having an identical twin. You know, you may not like it, but I mean, what difference? Now, what's interesting, and it's particularly interesting here, do you remember the time, you're probably too young to remember the time, before cloning, when people would say, intelligence is due to genes, I have never heard anything more fascist in my life, you right-wing swine, you know it's all due to the environment. They say, moralists say, no. Cloning, you know the child of someone who's cloned will be identical to the person whose genes they have in every possible way. If you cloned Hitler, he'd be exactly, they'd all be identical Hitlers. I hope you see the contradiction. You can't have it both ways. I don't know anybody else who's pointed this out. It's bizarre. And I do hope you do realize that cloning actually requires a pregnancy. I remember being on a program with Robin Day in which he said to me, now come on, Lewis, what about all these people who are Saddam Hussein's who are going to be cloned? And I said, who will the mothers be and where will they go to school? School, he said, mothers? What's that got to do with cloning? You don't pop out just from nowhere. I think that the issues related to genetic manipulation, really, I find it very hard to see severe ethical issues of any sort whatsoever. Well, genetic engineering carries risks. In other words, if you've got cystic fibrosis, and I want to put a gene, or if I've got cystic fibrosis, and you want to put a gene into me that will improve my cystic fibrosis, that's no different to a heart transplant. You know, you get lots of DNA put in when you have a transplant. Cloning so it affects the egg and carries on to the next generation, I can see there's a little ethical issues. People say, oh, you'll have designer babies and the rich will do better, but the rich do better anyhow. They send their children to private schools, they have cosmetic surgery. I follow Ronald Dworkin on this. Ronald Dworkin, who's a legal philosopher, who speaks about reproductive autonomy. That people should be allowed to reproduce in any way they like, so long as it does not do harm to others. And I find it very difficult to avoid that. And you know, we live in a society which has a curious set of double standards. Let me tell you what I mean. You want to have in vitro fertilization, as I understand it, you've got to sort of pass a sort of O-level in parenthood. Are you the sort of people who are the right people to have, to have a child? But let's say you want to have a child the normal way. You can be a drug addict, you can have AIDS, you can be a child abuser, you can be an alcoholic. Would anyone dare to say that you're not allowed to have a child? Say you know you have a severe genetic disease. Have you the right to have a child who you know is going to be severely disabled and which the state, in fact, will have to look after? I think these are severe ethical issues which do range, and it's about the application of science, not about the science itself. And I keep coming back to the application being different. And what I want to get emphasized here, applications require money. On the whole, scientists don't have money. I don't know where the money comes from. It's industrialists, bankers, and so forth. In general, scientists are not in control. They really aren't. Now, if we look around, if we look back through history and say, where have scientists really been shown to behave badly? Are there examples? Yes, I think there are. I think eugenics was very bad news. And this is a quotation from Darwin. Galton was the one who really thought about eugenics. Those who succeed in the race of wealth are by no means the best or the most intelligent, and it is notorious that our population is more largely renewed in each generation from the lower than from the middle and upper classes. And you will remember what happened in Nazi Germany, this belief, you know, the genetics, the germplasm, as they called it, determined what sort of people. And this is Conrad Lorenz, the famous animal behaviorist, talking about an analogy between bodies and malignant tumors on the one hand, and a nation and individuals within it who have become asocial because of their defective constitution. And he really was saying you must kill Jews and gypsies and people who you don't like. In what way did the scientists behave badly? They behaved badly because they weren't intellectually honest. What the scientists' responsibility is to tell the public about the implications of their science and also something about its reliability. And what happened with the eugenics movement, that the scientists started saying that prostitution and poverty, all these were genetically determined. And that's simply bizarre. I want to tell you that things have changed, I hope. And I am a eugenicist in the sense that I want to use genetics to help children not be born with severe abnormalities. And in Cyprus, for example, the church, together with prenatal diagnosis and the geneticists, have virtually wiped out a very nasty genetic disease, blood disease, called thalassemia, and that's straight eugenics. I cannot see anything wrong with prenatal diagnosis. I find it very difficult. Let me give you another example there. And I think really it's really all said on the slide. In fact, most of what I want to say is on the slide. I've only been going about 20 minutes. I've got about another 10, Tony? That's the way I've measured on my watch. Okay. This is Oppenheimer and the atom bomb we're on to now. The scientist is not responsible for the laws of nature, but it's the scientist's job to find out how these laws operate. It's the scientist's job to find out the ways these laws can serve the human will. It's not the scientist's job to determine whether a hydrogen bomb should be used, whether we should clone someone, whether there should be genetic engineering, whether we should use stem cells. This responsibility rests with the American people and their chosen representatives. I don't have time to tell you the story of Leo Szilard, who thought about the atom bomb just around the corner here in about 1936. He didn't make it public, but he told his representatives. There are those who say, oh, the scientists should never have been involved in that. They should have said, we won't get involved with making such a nasty weapon. But I think the point that you have to realize, would you have been happy if the scientists had done that, and then the Germans had built the bomb, and they'd won the war? Would you have then stood back and said, oh gosh, I'm so pleased our scientists made these moral decisions on our behalf? I don't think you would have, really. It's really not for scientists to make these decisions. It's for the scientists to be as open as they possibly can. I realize that in industry this may be difficult, but that's something that the individual scientist has to make, just as someone who works in the armaments industry. You have to decide. I mean, that I think, is the nature of the democracy. And on this point, I totally disagree with Sir Joseph Rotblat, Nobel Prize winner for the peace. And he wants scientists to take an oath. And let me read it to you. I promise to work for a better world where science and technology are used in socially responsible ways. I will use my education for any purpose. I will not use my education for any purpose intended to harm human beings or the environment. Throughout my career, I will consider the ethical implications of my work before I take action. While the demands placed upon me may be great, I sign this declaration because I recognize that individual responsibility is the first step on the path to peace. It sounds lovely, but I'm totally opposed to it. And let me tell you why. We enter the future backwards with science. When you're doing science, you do not know what applications can arise from it. The whole of genetic engineering, yes, is based on what are called restriction enzymes, chemicals that actually cut up DNA. No one was looking for them. They were discovered when a group of scientists were trying to understand how bacteria resisted infection from a particular kind of virus. You can't tell. You can't take responsibility for the way the world works. I think we enter the future backwards. You don't know how these things are going to work. You may say there are certain areas, and George Steiner has argued this, that are so politically dangerous, like difference in racial groups, for example, that no one should be allowed to work on them. I think the moment you start censoring reliable knowledge, you're on a very serious downhill track, and I am totally opposed to any restriction on scientific investigation. Of course, scientists have to behave ethically themselves. They mustn't lie, thief, cheat, you know, that you've got informed consent and so forth. But, you know, that's no different to the gas man who makes, you know, and everybody else in our society. I think it's also interesting, and I see you've got another session on the press. In people's minds, there is the view that the press believe that the public no longer trusts science. Rubbish. When people stop giving to cancer charities, then I'll begin to worry, or to medical charities in general, because we know, and everybody knows, that the only way we're going to get better cures in medicine is via science. Although some of my colleagues at work think it's going to come through humanities, but don't start me on that. It's a curious thing that this is this belief. And I think one has to really be quite worried about the image of BSC. Scientists had nothing to do with the feeding of cattle to cattle. It had nothing to do with science. And when the disease of BSC first came around, I spoke to Sir John Paterson about it, only about half a dozen scientists in the world who had the foggiest notion of what's going on. So I think that you can't ask scientists to be responsible for things. Now, you may say the scientists in the Ministry of Agriculture behaved badly by keeping it secret and so forth. That's another matter altogether. Openness really is all. And I also want to emphasize to you that everything in our society is dangerous. I keep pointing out to people, with this pair of glasses, I can do terrible damage to you. You want to see? No, I'm sure you don't want to see. I can do very nasty things with these. It's what you do with things. It's not the regional knowledge that really matters. Well, it matters. So, this I've stole from you, John. This is from John Adams. I've stolen this. It's one of his slides. And it's something that I hope I'm not distorting, but you show to your students. The chemical industry routinely uses a chemical called dihydrogen monoxide. It is used in significant quantities. It gets into the food supply. It's a major component of acid rain. Its vapor state is a major greenhouse gas. The chemical is known to have the following effects: in tumors, can cause vomiting, and accidental inhalation can kill you. And John, I think you said that when you asked your students whether it should be banned, do you think we should ban it? Let me ask the audience. You do know it's water, don't you? Well, it is water. So you've got to be jolly careful. One more. This one's more tricky. And it's about risk, and this isn't from John. So I just want to tell you how hard, I haven't spoken much about risk and judgment because that really is John Adams' expertise. I mean, his is one of the few books I've ever read that actually made me change my mind. It was a very painful process. A disease, so listen to this, you go to a doctor and you're told the following. A disease affects 1% of the population and the probability of the test detecting the disease is about 80%, so it's pretty reliable, the test. But there's also false positives, you know, you get a positive even when you have a 10%. So you're tested positive, should you worry? Should you rush home, write your will, go and see another 20 doctors? What do you think? Bet every doctor thinks so. It's not true. Take a random group of 1,000 people. Then we expect 10 to have the disease. That's the base rate. Base rates matter with risk. Of these 10, only 8 will be detected. Tests on the other 990 will give 100 false positives. Thus, only 8 out of 108 with a positive test will have the disease. You've got less than a 10% chance of having it in spite of the test. It's very counterintuitive. It's really nasty. It really is. I think I'm going to almost stop. Just let me say, yes, I just want to attack the politicians finally, and then I'll stop. And it's back to cloning and reproductive cloning and stem cells. Just to make my position clear about stem cells, I don't have time to explain it all to you. But just let me explain. You cannot be against cloning to make stem cells if you're in favor of in vitro fertilization. If you have strong religious beliefs and believe that the human being is a human being from the moment it's fertilized and therefore shouldn't be destroyed, which I cannot accept, but I can understand someone having such religious beliefs. But you cannot be for in vitro fertilization and against reproductive cloning. The only difference, The reason you one can be against it is because you destroy embryos. Not one member of parliament either understood that or had the guts to say it. And I find that slightly obscene. In the House of Lords, to be fair, they were a bit better. Here's a quotation from Tolstoy. Science is meaningless because it gives us no answer to our question, the only question important to us, what shall we do and how shall we be? Absolutely right. Science gives you no indication of ethical principles whatsoever. It can help you do something when you understand the principles, but it is ethically free. Reliable scientific knowledge has no value intrinsically whatsoever. And finally, my final slide, this is from Thomas Jefferson, which really sums up everything that I want to say. I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise that control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take that right from them, but to inform their discretion. And that's, I think, a major role for scientists. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thanks very much. Now we have the comments from our panel. We're going from left to right across here, so I asked Rod Smith to start off and speak for.
Why don't you speak from here? Unless, do you need a. Oh.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to pick up the theme that our speaker introduced by distinguishing between science and technology. And of course I agree wholly that science by itself is nothing but a knowledge base. The technology and the engineering that we use to create things creates a dangerous and risky society. I don't particularly want to deal with ethical issues, but to talk about the dangers of living and risk, and perhaps anticipate something that John Adams will say. So it's not what you do, it's what you create that is important in this lecture. We live in a dangerous world, in a globe spinning through space, receiving energy from the sun. We are in many ways in conflict with our environment. Since the beginning of the knowledge base that enabled us to create the Industrial Revolution, many of our activities have grown in an exponential way. The nature of exponential growth is a sort of runaway growth. It means, for example, in terms of population, there are more people alive today than have died throughout history. The scale of our activities is changing the equilibrium of our globe, and this has got serious consequences. Everything that we see around us has been created by this activity called technology and engineering. The seats that you are sitting in, the projectors that we're using to make this presentation, everything about this building, every artifact of our life is obtained by mining, drilling, capturing, harvesting natural resources from the earth and using vast quantities of energy to process those materials to make products that we use and eventually discard. The manufacturing process itself creates a lot of waste. I read yesterday that in 24 hours in Britain, in 1 hour in Britain, we create enough waste to fill the Albert Hall. Rather startling statistic. We've got an economic system that is only satisfied with growth. A 3% doubling in an exponential growth system means that activities double in 23 years. 5% growth rate means activities double in 14 years. And in each doubling period, we consume the same amount of resource as all the previous doubling periods combined. This is clearly unsustainable, and it's a huge risk to us all. Turning to risk, the difference between the public's perception and quantitative data. It is clear that we find it much easier to accept voluntary risks rather than imposed ones. We like to be in individual control rather than controlled by others. We like to see clear benefits of the activity to which we are asked to acquiesce. We prefer natural risk to man-made ones and familiar ones to exotic ones. We're happier to expose adults rather than children to risk, and we dislike the possibility of catastrophic failures. Here are some scenes from my everyday life. I leave it to you to judge in which scene I'm exposed to most risk. Reading my novel, smoking a pipe, growing fat, taking no exercise, or climbing up a rock face, or gliding through the air in a plane without any engine, or taking a railway ride. It's a strange thing that if we try to quantify risk, and I've put down here some loss of life expectancy for a 40-year-old male, measured in days, the very fact of being male means that you lose about 8 years on a woman. This seems to me a rather poor deal. You may want to change the situation. There are risks involved in trying to do so. The serious point about this is a point that was made in the earlier presentation about everyday life being a dangerous activity and containing risk. Every activity that we take. But you will notice that the man-made risks in this slide are very, very much smaller than the natural risks that we have to accept. Many people would think that an airline crash is perhaps something that we might be exposed to, or a dam failure. Quantitatively, they're very much lower on the risk scale than the activities here. And I've picked out 100% nuclear electricity supply, a height of technology, disliked by most people, very uncertain about it, very unknowing about the technology that surrounds it, but convinced that it's a bad thing, will take perhaps order of 1.5 days of our lives, which seems to me considerably smaller than the 2,800 risk of being a male. Last week, the government chief scientific advisor came to the uncomfortable conclusion that nuclear power would have to be embraced. Why did he use the word uncomfortable? If he was certain about the technology grounds and risk grounds on which he based that assessment, it's completely unnecessary to use the word uncomfortable. In transport, which is my own speciality, you've all seen tables like this, which in many senses are completely meaningless. Let me take the risk of using a train. Every 2 journeys out of 100 million, one might expect to have to be killed. Absolutely meaningless number. If I take a kilogram bag of sugar, on average it contains about 1 million grains of sugar. So this risk is equivalent to taking 100 kilogram bags of sugar and representing the chances of death by 2 grains out of those 100 bags. It's very interesting that we're spending so much money to improve that situation. When we accept risks of being male, for example, quite cheerful. Well, most of us are cheerful. So there's some myths about risk, that the issues are too difficult for the public to understand. And I think this is the importance of lectures like this, which begin to propagate a debate about risk. I think it's our duty to explain to the public, to try harder to simplify and explain the consequences of not taking certain actions as well as the consequences of taking the action. Telling the public is more likely to unduly alarm them than keeping quiet. I think people should be allowed to express their concerns in an open debate. Technical decisions should be left in the hands of technical people. Well, provide information, but perhaps use non-specialists to transmit that information. This is the problem that I've called the instruction book problem, always written by an expert who's used the machine and not by the first-time user. A myth that activist groups are responsible for stirring up unwarranted concerns. I think activist groups focus public anger and may share many common goals, and we should work with them. The Prime Minister came to Imperial a short time ago, middle of February, and expressed a great interest in science, having been claimed, like most of our leaders, to be very poor of it at school. But now he's, in his own words, absolutely fascinated by it. And I think that's an interesting beginning of education, 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 beginning at home. And I would like to propagate that interest in science and technology and the risks involved in it to a much wider audience. I think those comments are fine just for the moment. Thank you.
So far.
Are you going to speak from here, David?
Yes, if I may. I think, conscious of time, Chairman, just a few observations. I come to this as a previous physician in there, and recognizing that for most of history, medicine has been about observation, and very skillful observation at that. And it's probably only in the last 50 years, and accelerating to pick up the point that Lewis has made, that we've seen medicine moving into being able to intervene, and intervene increasingly sophisticated. And that brings with it the trade-off between risk and benefit. And much of my activity has been around that trade-off as a regulator, previously for the pharmaceutical industry, and now for the medical devices industry. And it's interesting, both examples you took are spectacles, which are medical devices, and the reference to diagnostics there are part of the things which we are responsible for. And it's interesting, in this country, we've calculated that 38 million of us in this country use a medical device each and every day. That just gives you some feel for the sort of interventions that we have around us. I think if you look at some of the issues which we're dealing with as regulators, we have to make a decision. It's either yes or it's no. We're either allowing the device or the medicine onto the market with caveats, with labeling, with restrictions, or we're not. So we are forced to come to a decision, often in the circumstances where there is still uncertainty. And it's very interesting to see in the media almost every day stories around miracle cure, great expectation, often around very early results, at proof of concept stage, where people want to believe that we found a cure for cancer, for hereditary disease, and so on and so forth, and want it licensed with the minimum of data. And yet in the same newspapers, the same television program, we will see concerns over long-term safety or risks with existing treatments. And the truth is, we can't have one without the other, that we have to try and make judgments. And we recognize as regulators and in medicine that every intervention has a risk which we have to trade off for the benefits. And part of the problem, I think, is to move away from paternalistic regulation to giving, as was said, more transparency, more openness, and sharing some of the uncertainties. And to recognize that we have, as regulators, to allow the industries we regulate to develop. We have to encourage innovation, because not only is that the industries there, but actually is bringing benefit to people, to patients. But try to reflect some of that, and to recognize that increasingly, we're talking about interventions which are going to be for long duration. And therefore, how are we to take those very significant innovations forward as we have to look to see what is the long-term benefit, what is the long-term safety? Now, in many instances, are we going to wait the 5 or 10 years for the studies to be done, very expensive in themselves, and who's going to pay for them? Probably the industries, certainly the devices industry, wouldn't be able to. Or are we going to move ahead and then observe the effects with tight control and then have to intervene? And recognize as a consequence of that, we may have to restrict usage as time passes. So we have a very difficult exercise in terms of communicating risk, of trying to educate society that if they want rapid innovation and benefits, they come at a price. And somehow we have to try and move that forward. So just a number of thoughts there where we as regulators come from. And perhaps important to recognize that throughout the European Union, the final choice on difficult issues doesn't lie with the regulators or with our advisory committees. It actually, to pick up the point, lies with politicians and with Parliament. I think that is right. And increasingly in all our advisory committees now, we have lay representation. It's very important that we're picking up on those issues. So my concern is about the issue of risk communication, of risk perception, and how we can influence that, and how importantly we can seek to manage risk in an open society in the internet age where people have a vast array of information, but how can we try and give a balanced view there to people who are often very vulnerable at the time when they're seeking that information? So those are just some thoughts to add and perhaps to put into our debate there, Chairman.
Can I just push you just to say, is that inconsistent with what Lewis said, or consistent with it?
I think it's a slight variance in there. I think where I have to apply this day in, day out. But I think increasingly I see a number of uncertainties and divergences. I well remember the debate which took place a couple of years ago around GM food, where the concern was over the provenance of the GM component, the excipient, in a biotechnology medicine. Nobody was worried about the biotechnology medicine, but they were worried about whether the excipient in there, the starch, could be GM starch. That illustrates to me some of the unscientific thinking that was going on, rather than appreciating the true science and understanding. And that's part of the problem which I see. So that I very much agree with Lewis on.
Okay, thank you. Now turn to John Adams for the final commentary.
Well, Lewis has cleared up one mystery for me. He said he wouldn't allow a scientist to choose his tie. And I assume that's why I've never seen him wearing one. In fact, judging by the empirical evidence available to me, I suspect maybe he doesn't even own one. I find his argument absolutely convincing, so long as I can maintain his distinction between the scientist and the technology and the technologist as two people who are two distinct people who can remain distinct. But I haven't encountered many scientists who aren't passionately interested in the utility of their discoveries. And I think, again, you're not your best advertisement for the argument, because I get the impression that you're often passionate about the possibilities of your science curing disease. And so I think he wouldn't be human if he didn't have that passionate interest in the potential use of his science. So is science dangerous? Well, I think you pretty much rephrased the question. Is knowledge dangerous? There are large and well-funded institutions like the MI6 and CIA whose very existence assumes that to be the case. I think the answer, so knowledge, yes, sometimes it's beneficial and other times it's dangerous, and how we decide which, I think usually comes down to who controls it and whether we think they're on our side. It's already been mentioned by Rod that it matters hugely whether a risk is seen as voluntary or imposed. Take mobile phones. The science is contested. It's pretty one way, but there are still people who contest the danger of holding this thing to your ear and will it fry your brain or something worse. Now, that is a voluntary risk that people around the world are queuing up in their billions to take. The science, so far as I can understand it, suggests that the radiation emitted from the base stations, unless you're up the mast with your ear to the transmitter, the radiation dose is orders of magnitude less than the dose you get when you have the phone to your ear. And yet almost all the opposition to mobile phones is focused on the base stations. They are seen as impositions. People, if they don't see a clear benefit, will resent and oppose even the tiniest risk. Another example, GM foods. The debates I've sat in on about GM foods have usually persuaded me that the science isn't threatening in health or safety terms. But the debate then usually drifts away to the economic power of Monsanto and the fear that they ultimately will be dictating to the lowliest farmer in Kerala what seeds they can buy and what fertilizers and so on. So I think control and perceived control are absolutely crucial to a judgment about what knowledge is safe or dangerous. Now, Lewis said that through science we enter the world backwards. It's difficult to predict what the outcome will be. But most scientists I know they speculate. Their speculations are usually called hypotheses. We non-scientists do the same thing and speculate. The risk is inherently subjective. It's a word that relates to the future, which doesn't exist except in our imaginations. Have very different people have very different takes on what this future might hold. And you find some who say that if you can't prove it's safe, you must operate on the assumption that it's dangerous and invoke the precautionary principle at every turn, such as Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. You have your buccaneering capitalists who say if you can't prove it's dangerous, we must work on the assumption that it's safe until proven otherwise. And so on. But I'll finish with just one example where I fear that science and technology together, and I think they do go together, are possibly making the world more dangerous from my perspective, in the sense that they are creating more and more risks which are beyond my ability and most of our abilities to influence. It's a theme that relates to our chairman's brief lectures, Runaway World. The science and technology together have a tendency to make problems larger. A few years ago, I got invited to speak to a conference of science fiction writers on the theme of transport planning. And I challenged them. I said, I could not find a single example from the genre of science fiction in which distance had been conquered by science and technology. I could not find a single example of a plausible working democracy. The form of government, whether it's Star Wars, Brave New World, 1984, the form of government is tyrannical hierarchy. The scale of problems has grown too large to be managed by any form of government that we might recognize as democratic. And when problems grow to a scale that leaves them beyond effective democratic control, then from my perspective, that makes them dangerous.
Thank you. John, you wouldn't like to take a pump for this bottle of champagne, even though I think it's as mythical as Lewis's tie, probably. But would you question what he said about cloning or not? Maybe he's got the champagne with him by the side of his chair, but I sort of doubt it.
I've collected all those double bottles that you've made instead.
I need more thinking time on that one. I'm risk averse on that one.
Okay, well, in that case, I'll be
very brief because the audience wants to come in. Can I just point out, and just picking up the point about dangers, really, if you really want to know one of the most dangerous things in the world is gravity. How many of your friends have fallen down steps? I want to tell you, for the over 60s, it's in the tens of thousands who fall down and damage them. Gravity is the real danger in our society. Consider how many friends you know who've fallen down and broken their ankles, fallen down steps, crashed in the... Sorry, okay. I'm totally for the regulators. I think it's a very hard job.
I think gravity stopped us falling down as well.
Sorry?
Doesn't gravity stop us falling down as well?
Oh, dear, Tony. No, I'm terribly sorry. No, it doesn't. We have a different image on that. I also want to make the point that knowledge is not the same as science. Knowing that we're at LSE at the moment is knowledge, but it has nothing to do with science. Science is about understanding and its general principles. It's not terribly interested in the particular. I'm not passionate about trying to help people. I'm terribly sorry. I should pretend I could, and I always put it on my grant applications. This will help people regenerate their limbs and so forth. It's not what I care about. I'm really just interested in the science. I'm terribly sorry, but that's the honest truth. GM foods, just quickly about that. The newspapers love genetic pornography and Frankenstein foods. And I think the point that you were really making is that when people see that GM foods will make them younger, more beautiful, more potent, or whatever it is, they'll gobble them up. Can I just remind you, at the height of the BSC crisis, I can't remember, one of the supermarkets, Sainsbury's or Tesco's, reduced the price of their meat, their beef, by half. It was sold out in 25 minutes. The people are very rational. Listen, I'm a cyclist. It's high risk, but it's benefit. We all have some complicated, I mean, I'm taking this from John. You must read his book on risk. It's really important. It's about risk-benefit analysis. And we somehow live in that sort of peculiar way. I don't think, thank you, that's enough.
Well, the floor is open for questions or comments. There should be roving mics around the room. So would someone like to open the proceedings? Maybe a gentleman there.
Very much enjoyed your lecture, Lewis, and it's always a pleasure to hear what you have to say. I was very happy to publish your paper on the nature of the gene. However, I would like to take exception to your remarks about social science. I wonder how many articles in sociology and serious journals you've read recently, and I would like to throw the champagne challenge to you to come up with a clear difference between social science and natural science. I know that a lot of stuff that isn't in fact science goes under the label of social science, and that's something that is a bit of a problem, and we're going to have to do something about it. But nevertheless, there is such a thing as serious science in social science, and to hear physicists and others talk about risk when an economist talk about it, it's just worlds apart, and it's so naive the way most of the non-social science people talk about subjects like risk, say. So, what do you say?
I'm sorry, I think I misled you. I think I didn't really mean to attack social science at all, please. It's the sociologists of science that I hate. It's the people who really pretend to say, it's the relativists, the people, the social constructivists. And I'm not terribly impressed with those people in the social sciences who work on risk. I have nothing, I have too little knowledge of the social sciences to say anything about them whatsoever. I'm sorry, I misled you if I was attacking sociology.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
I think anyone, please, any of the panel respond to any of the questions, though. So one of
Yeah, my name's Bill Doherty from New College, Oxford. I was just, I didn't have time to write down all of Rod Smith's risk myths, but I just wanted to pick up on a couple just out of interest. It's better to tell the public always than to keep quiet. So I want to know why I wasn't told what the risk of catching Legionnaire's disease is when I walked in here tonight. Well, actually, because sensible people made a decision that that was an irrelevant risk that I didn't need to know about. And there is a danger in assuming that that is a risk myth, that we are simply going to be flooded with irrelevant information. And therefore, it appears to me as a bit of a simplistic myth. Secondly, technical decisions are best left in the hands of technical people. You say that's a myth. And obviously, I suspect you nuance these phrases more appropriately when you're lecturing at Imperial. But I mean, obviously, in many instances, that's simply an abdication of responsibility. I expect doctors, whilst they may inform me, to make decisions. Obviously, they are trying to engage me in that decision-making process. But at the end of the day, they've got 7 years minimum of training more than I have. And to say, here's the information, now you decide, is actually just a blame avoidance or a strategy or an abdication of responsibility. And just very finally, I was very pleased to hear that the Prime Minister is fascinated increasingly by science. I've got one policy prescription. Let's test him. Let's see, let's run past the same science exams that he did when he was at school to him now, and let's see whether his new fascination in science is actually scientifically based or merely a moral assumption.
Or maybe a political gambit, yeah. Who would like to comment?
I just want to make a comment about
it's
doctors.
It's not just Lewis, it's also everybody on the panel.
We weren't attacking you, but the other. I just want to make a point about doctors. I'm totally against doctors taking ethical decisions. I want them to make medical decisions. I don't want them to be paternalistic. I think that's very important. So I think they really need to inform the patient.
Could I come back briefly, too, on that?
Yes,
one?
Please.
I mean, I was. Obviously, in the time that I got, one can't go into detail. I was thinking of large questions that affect society. For example, would it be a sensible course of action to build more nuclear power stations? I mean, I don't think that is a decision that technologists should take in the comfort that they think it will be a good idea. It's something that needs explaining to the public at large. Obviously, you can pick examples at...
that's a call for politics, not science. I mean, one of the problems I find with this discussion, I think it's evident to most people that science itself is not a democratic process. And there is a danger that we are trying to use science in an instrumental fashion to regenerate political engagement. Whereas in fact, it's evident, I would have thought, that the dynamic is much more the other way around. We've debated mostly this evening the effect of science on society, but the impact of society on science is also a missing link in this discussion. I want to see proper democratic engagement, but I don't want to see science usurped to creating that, much as I don't want to see the arts.
Well, I think I was talking about the application of technology to society rather than science, which is a different activity.
No, please. I mean, you seem to question this division between science and technology. So.
Well, I was going to pick up the Bill Derodier's point on the effect of science on society, society on science, and relate it to an earlier point about cultural relativism. It seems to me that there are two sorts of knowledge. One sort, risk perceived through science, where you have microscopes and scientific training that helps you understand what you're looking at, and you might see cholera, and that gives you a fairly good scientifically informed grip on that particular problem. But there are other sorts of problems that get discussed scientifically where the science is utterly inconclusive. As I read the argument, the BSE debate is still in that category. And it has been bedeviled from the very beginnings of the public debate by competing scientific hypotheses. And so long as you're dealing with a phenomenon where it's postulated that there are lag times of years or even decades, it's likely to be some time before you have a reasonably conclusive answer around which a scientific consensus can form. But you're confronted with hypotheses, some scary, some reassuring, that politicians feel obliged to react to. And I think when you're in that realm, you really are in the realm of risk socially or culturally constructed, because what you're inclined to do with this uncertain knowledge, well, if you're the sort of person who says, well, if we can't prove it's safe, we have to assume it's dangerous and ban beef on the bone and everything, and the alternative view, if you can't prove it's dangerous, assume it's safe and publish everything you know and let the shopper decide, would be the alternative view. But those are views, neither one of which can be firmly defended by science.
I think the issue of BSE is, you know, whether it's prions or not. But when someone talks about science not being democratic, I have not the foggiest notion what nonsense you're talking about.
We vote whether the sun goes down the earth.
I'm terribly sorry. You want to vote on it? Did you say? Terribly sorry, I don't understand.
By the way, the sun doesn't go round the earth.
We had the next question was in the middle here somewhere. You've got the microphone. I think
is that on? Yeah. John Fox, Cancer Research UK, used to be Imperial Cancer Research Fund. One way it seems to me that science can be dangerous, which I'm sure most people in the hall will agree with, is when it takes a position, there's only one correct way of understanding the world, and that's a particular scientific perspective. That's not actually a criticism of you, Lewis, but it is perhaps a criticism of how the orthodoxy views risk itself, in which we tend to view as a mathematical concept with a particular interpretation according to certain axioms, which has caused all kinds of trouble. Many people on the panel and elsewhere have discussed this in their own work. And it seems to me, actually, for a variety of reasons I won't go into now, that mathematics has a great deal to learn technically, formally, from the way that people understand risk. And they understand risk in ways that's sort of meaning-laden, and they often misunderstand risk for that reason. But they also deeply understand it. And I think I've shown in some of the work I've been involved with, that risk itself is due for a revolution in our understanding. Does the panel consider any credibility of that position at all, or do they just think people are completely irrational when it comes to understanding risk?
Irrational.
Do you view people as irrational when it comes to understanding threats to themselves and their own lives?
Well, I can only speak as a cyclist, of course. It's risk-benefit. Sorry, I think you can never think about risk without benefit. What, you know, mountain climbers. So I find it difficult. You know, I ride my bicycle. The statistical chances of me having a severe accident are high, but I love it. It's my illusion of youth, and I'm faster than a motor car.
I think what I see from the medical side is quite often, until very recently, patients saw a clear benefit and therefore were very prepared to accept risk and to trade that off. Where I think we find difficulties is when we're talking about very long-term benefits to the individuals, and that I think is where it gets more difficult in there. I and my statistical department, I used to manage one there, had great hopes for the National Lottery, but I think it's slightly worrying that, as I hear every Saturday, we hear that certain balls have got a memory and have come out. I think that's damaged a little bit of our understanding on all there. But I think the general public does have quite a good grasp of some of the basis of risk in there, if one is trying to take it forward in that light. I think as we as regulators sometimes have to recognize that there is not a mathematical formula which we can apply. Rather, we have to look progressively how we can limit the risk. And it may be in one scenario, at a certain level, you're going to take a medicine off the market or a device. In others, because there is still a benefit there, you're going to do your very best to keep that available with putting further restrictions on there and so on. And that is the art of regulation, as it were, as you try and move something forward. So I think that, yes, there is an inherent ability of the population to understand if you are prepared to communicate it sufficiently and to put enough effort into it.
I listened to a very sad report on the radio last week about some children who were killed on a school adventure trip. And the reporter was insistent that adventure trips must be made as safe as possible. Now, we all know what that person meant, and the public would have some sympathy for that point of view, but the question is, when does the adventure trip cease being an adventure trip if it's as safe as possible?
And what's your answer?
I haven't got an answer to it. I mean, it's a personal judgment. John's thermostat's probably working overtime to come up with an answer. But, I mean, that's true. In fact, I find safety equipment for dangerous sports is almost an oxymoron. So, you know, it's a very interesting... We do dangerous things because we enjoy living on the edge. You know, an orange without juice is a tasteless thing. Well, you enjoy the sweat in your palms when you're on the rock face. That's what living on the edge is about.
One definition of risk is doing something that carries with it a probability of an adverse outcome. So you cannot take risks without having accidents. And aspiring to zero risk is to aspire to zero risk. And if you aspire to zero risk, you must also forego all the potential rewards of risk-taking. And I think what is happening increasingly, those of you who are familiar at all with the risk literature, there's a quantitative risk assessment school that likes to use these branching trees called fault trees or event trees, where you look at a whole chain of probabilities that can culminate in some nasty outcome. And usually they work from the left side of the page to the right, and by the time you get to the right margin, all the probabilities associated with nasty outcomes are impressively small numbers. And so you go ahead. Well, I think that's a good metaphor for the way most of us deal with a lot of risks in life. We peer through the dense shrubbery of the fault trees and event trees, and so far as we can see them, all the risks are pretty tiny and worth taking. And then one of these rare events happens, and you end up in court, And the clever barrister for the opposition brings out his machete and hacks away all the other branches in the event tree or the fault tree, and you're left with this direct line back to the original stupidity. And what, with the benefit of foresight, was a risk worth taking. With the benefit of hindsight and a clever lawyer, becomes culpable negligence. And I think this is what is happening in these postmortems, such as every education is phenomenally safe. If you work in an educational institution, including going on school trips, you're something like 35 times less likely to die than if you're outside school hours. And yet, every one of these things, every one of these very unfortunate events, is subjected to this peculiar way of looking at it, and the result is significant rewards for risk taking are going to be sacrificed. A school teachers' union has advised their members no longer to take school trips. It's not worth the career risk.
Thanks. We had a question from over. Two questions from that side.
David Sprout, biomedical scientist. Can I address Professor Alpert in the first instance? I disagree with so much of what you said. I'm in some form of overload. And I've forgotten most of the arguments. But what I'd like to pick out is that I don't believe that people give money to cancer research because they trust scientists. It's my contention that they give money as a sort of insurance policy because the chances are they are going to get cancer at some time. As for scientists versus technologists, so many scientists now work in drug companies or nuclear power or anything else that damages the environment that they cannot sort of avoid guilt and say that they're not involved in the technology. It is a guilt avoidance procedure, I think. And everyone is now looking, I believe, for some spiritual buffer against what they see science is doing wrong, how it's affecting their world, and how it's likely to affect their lives. And I think people are afraid of science for that reason. They don't know what's coming. And I don't think it's honest to say that scientists are just studying their subject purely out for the seeking knowledge. Too many scientists know, and a number that I know, are actually doing it to make money, and that's the crux of the matter.
So I never said that scientists on the whole were just doing it to create knowledge. I said that's what I do. I'm very noble and honorable, you see. I think there's a difficulty here. I couldn't agree with you about the insurance point and why people give money to... I'm out of my depth, ask the cat. I think the boundary between science and technology is not as clear as I make it, and there are many scientists working in technology, but I'm not talking about the scientists, I'm talking about science. There's a distinct difference between knowing how to clone someone and actually doing it. There's an enormous difference between knowing how to make a bomb and actually doing. There's the distinction between understanding. It's not about knowledge, it's about science, and actually applying that knowledge, and that's the distinction I'm drawing. Sure, there are lots of scientists doing technology. Scientists are really quite human. They want to make money, they want to be successful, sorry. Scientists can be dangerous, but that's quite different from science. Of course.
Yeah.
Sorry? Absolutely not. I agree with you. But science is the knowledge one acquires from scientists. It's quite different from what the scientists... All right, we're bickering.
This will have to be our last question from the questioner over there.
Hi, I have a really simple question that I'd like the panel to address.
Can you just speak a bit more? Is the mic on?
I'm much better at shouting.
Good.
Whoop. Well, no, we can't hear at all now.
This is Sorry, gravity I happening.
I was saying I have a really simple question that I'd like the panel to address perhaps, and that's to do with the professor's assumption that science is value-free and objective. Perhaps some of the members of the panel could comment on that, please.
Well, I can't comment because I believe that to be true.
Can I make a point?
While they're hesitating, the point about science being objective, let's pretend we rerun science. We restart again. We go back, okay? And there are a group of people who are interested in science. They're not the Greeks, they're the Shmeeks, whoever they are. And we rerun history, yes? The answers we get will be indistinguishable from those that we have now. Water will be H2O. It may be called googledy-guggledy,
but it'll still be H2O. The periodic table will be there. Genes will code for proteins. And that's what I mean by it being a drug. And the real point about science, and I think it's very difficult for people, and someone raised it, to any set of phenomena, there's only one and only correct scientific explanation. The trick is to find it.
Can I try and relate your question to the earlier question about whether scientists are trusted? And I think that ordinary people, when confronted that with that question, find great difficulty in separating knowledge and science from its uses. And what the surveys have shown is that it depends who the scientist is working for. A scientist working for an environmental organization generally commands a much higher level of trust than one working for government or big business. And so these declarations of trust or lack of it, I think, say something about imputed motive.
I'd agree with Lewis. I think that science itself is value-free. I think we are talking about fundamental relationships, whether we're talking about physics or molecular biology. I think what has changed in the last 20 years and is accelerating is the speculation by both pure and applied scientists. And increasingly, one is finding a pure science paper and then speculation around the press release occurring at the same time as that paper. And I think that is creating a huge amount of interest and then disappointment and some degree of mistrust. So I think we have seen a change of people taking the pure science and then wanting to speculate around what that may mean way beyond the science themselves. And I think that is a change we have seen and is causing some difficulties now.
Well, I agree quite firmly that science is the base of knowledge which is value-free, and that's quite different from the actions of and motives of scientists.
Well, what I'd like to do, just to conclude, is to ask each panelist just to briefly answer the question, is science dangerous? And then we'll come to a conclusion. So I'll just work across from
science by itself isn't dangerous. The application of science through technology can be extremely dangerous, and both in a risk sense and in an ethical sense. My rather simple view.
No, I don't think science itself is dangerous. I think the application of science has been, on the whole, very positive for our society, and sometimes we forget the very profound benefits because of some of the real risks. I think we have to manage those, as we've said today, but I think we do have to sort of have the scorecard and recognize the balance, the benefits which have come from applied science, as well as the clear benefits of understanding science itself.
I think science can be dangerous, especially when one is in the realms of hypothesis, the speculations that are driving science, and when those speculations get out into the wider world, it's very difficult for politicians not to act upon them. And so a hypothesis about BSE, for example, depending on the conviction or convincingness with which it is conveyed, can lead to very different policies. So my answer is sometimes.
I, of course, don't think it is, but it's quite amusing. We haven't mentioned the word motor car. We talk about risk-benefit. I take these figures from you again, John. I think it's 250,000 people a year are either killed or damaged by motor cars. Where's the ethical committee for motor cars? They're not to be found. GM foods the hysteria. Where did you last see an ethical committee really standing up and say, we mustn't have motor cars? Can you imagine now, if blood transfusion hadn't been invented? Headline in Daily Mail, Dracula scientists. You know, I think you've got to put these things in some sort of strange perspective. Science is not dangerous. What's dangerous is gravity and human beings.
Can I just try a scientific experiment? How many people in the audience are from Imperial College? Oh, very good.
Very good.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thanks very, very much for coming all this distance to this discussion. Can I just remind you of what I said at the beginning, that the next in this series, the next discussion, is entitled Who Says Our Food is Safe? And that's happening at the LSE on the 29th of April, and everyone in this audience is cordially invited to come. I think everyone here is also invited to the reception, which is happening on the, I believe, fifth floor of the old building, the main building where the Porter's Lodge is of the LSE. Anyone doesn't know it, please pick up somebody who does know it who will show you the way if you want to come to the reception. And in the meantime, can I just say thanks to Lewis for a characteristically trenchant presentation, and to our panel for the discussion, and to the audience for your participation. Thanks very, very much.